I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Whether about perceived threats from outside the country or within, Americans have always had a tendency to panic. That goes back to Salem in the late 17th century. And over the years, Americans burned Catholic convents, certain they were secret covens. The same kind of irrational fears show up at many places in our history, says our guest today, historian and screenwriter Mark Stein. From the hysteria that drove the genocide of Native tribes and the persecution of blacks, to targets ranging from immigrant Jews, Freemasons, and corporations, to the post-9/11 fears about Muslims, Mark Stein provides a look at who scares us and why. That's coming up on Midday after the news. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. We tend to think of the Salem witch trials as ancient history, but our guest this hour says they were just the beginning of a long American tradition of religious, political, and ethnic panic. Almost from the start, Americans reviled Native Indians as vile, barbaric, and godless threats to settlers and their farms. The result was ethnic cleansing on a continental scale that lasted more than 200 years. Biblical justifications fostered early hysteria over African Americans, as did fears of a slave revolt that resulted in a century of repressive Jim Crow laws after the Civil War. In a provocative new book called American Panic, Mark Stein, a playwright, screenwriter, and popular historian, describes the people who scare us and why. Fears of papal influence led to centuries of actions against Catholics. One alleged plot led the Maryland General Assembly to ban the practice of the Catholic religion here, even though the state was founded by Catholics. Fear of Freemasons, with their secret oaths and rituals, have long been fed public hysteria. So have fears of foreigners, the Chinese who built America's railroads, the European Jews who came in the late 19th century, and more recently, the Central American immigrants who have flooded over the borders with Mexico. Mark Stein says the very notion of women's suffrage produced hysteria. Anti-gay sentiment peaked in the first half of the 20th century, and the attacks of 9/11 have produced a torrent of anti-Muslim sentiment. Panic, Mark Stein says, is fomented by people who demonize and vilify their targets, painting them all as a single menace. American panic is also more problematical than it is in some other countries because of one of the Constitution's bedrock freedoms. You can't outlaw hate speech here. It's a fascinating subject, and we'll learn more about it from Mark Stein in this hour of the show. He's a playwright whose works have been performed off-Broadway. He's also been a screenwriter. His first popular history, How the States Got Their Shapes, became the basis for a History Channel series by the same name and was also a New York Times bestseller for a while. And Mark, the last time Mark was on the show was with that book. His latest is called American Panic, A History of Who Scares Us and Why, available from Palgrave Macmillan. Mark Stein, nice to have you back on the show with us.
Thank you, Dan. Good to be here.
What got you to this subject? What were you thinking about from the last book, which I really enjoyed, How the States Got Their Shapes? How'd you make that transition into this subject?
Well, it wasn't anything to do with the last book. It was, as one might guess, the headlines and all the vehemence in the political discourse today. And by that, I don't simply mean coming from conservatives. Struck as well by things I would hear from friends, relatives, if you will, people from the left,
mm-hmm.
Who were like freaked out about
something.
Well, usually people from the right.
Uh-huh. Right.
But I was kind of hearing the same kind of rhetoric or kind of fears, and I wanted to look back because I knew from my playwriting days that Arthur Miller's play The Crucible. During the McCarthy era, I was using the Salem witch hunt, and I thought, how far does that panic, that pattern of panic that Arthur Miller pointed up, how much is there to that? And so I really started scratching around and then getting very interested in patterns in the different political panics throughout history, no matter what realm they come from.
Are we in a state of panic now? The reason I ask that question is because of the immigration crisis, described as a crisis, a flood of immigrants, many of them unaccompanied children who've come across the border since the fall of 2013, going on, we're approaching a year since this has been happening. A Reuters poll, let me read you the results of a Reuters poll on this subject. A Reuters poll showing that Americans are deeply worried that illegal immigration is threatening the nation's culture and its economy. 70% of Americans, including 86% of Republicans, believe undocumented immigrants threaten traditional U.S. beliefs and customs. Now, the part about the economy I get, because you hear people frequently say there aren't enough jobs here. We cannot provide for people the health and other social services they may need who come here in poverty, come across the border to live in the United States. Those are arguments I've heard. But also, but when you get into changing the nation's culture, a concern of, that our traditional U.S. beliefs, whatever those are, and customs, whatever those are threatened by immigrants. That begins to sound like panic to me.
Yeah, I think the key phrase that you just used is begins to sound like panic. In the book, I make a distinction between something that I will say this is a symptom of panic, and other things I'll say this is panic-inducing.
So do you think we're in a state of panic today, well, based on your definition? And this is a good time to go into your definition of it.
Sure. I think it's very tricky to give a clear definition. And so what I say in the book is the only time I feel comfortable saying that's panic, political panic, American political panic, in fact, is when we do or advocate that which we fear, so that fearing that some group threatens our nation, if we then do things that weaken free speech or due process of law or things like that, we weaken the nation. We do that which we fear. That to me is a clear symptom of panic. But much more frequently, we're talking about, as in your example, what in the book I would call panic-inducing, things that kind of lead to what I call the portal to panic. And I don't try to then say, here's the bright, shiny line. And therefore, to answer your question, we are in a, if not period of panic, certainly a very panic-inducing time. Things like the response to that poll suggest that. That immigrants are a threat to our culture, to our way of life.
Our traditional U.S. beliefs. What would they threaten? How would undocumented immigrants threaten our traditional U.S. beliefs? You know, while we're here on the air, folks are listening to us, and we can invite our listeners to call in and share this discussion with us, because I'd like to know what that means to people. Perhaps you even took part in this poll, this Reuters poll that's out this summer, 410-662-8780. So I'm going to give that number there, Mark, so our listeners can take part here. Also, our toll-free number is 866-661-9309. And our email address for Midday, comments or questions for Mark Stein while he joins us during this hour to talk about American panic, a history of who scares us and why. Our email address is midday@wypr.org. Here's an example I took from your book, defining panic as a fear that causes people to get so upset that they do the very thing they're afraid is happening. For example, public opposition to construction of Muslim mosques because many Americans believe Muslims want to rule the world by their particular law, Sharia law, right? Panic may involve internal or external threats like the Red Menace. And although we think of it as an artifact of the 50s, communism, panic reactions to communism date back to the days of Karl Marx himself. So this has been around for a while, and I guess it rises to panic when we actually take some action as a result of fear and not rational thought. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. That's when I say we can clearly say that that's panic.
And you're talking about political social panic here.
Yes.
Because panic is also something you associate with financial panic, sure. economic panic,
sure.
right?
That
we
sure.
have, we've had several of them over the years.
Right, and there's something called panic anxiety or something that psychiatrists or psychologists talk about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not in that. I may be in the neighborhood of that realm, but
you're looking at political and social panic.
Yes, so with the concern about particularly currently with so many children coming into the country, and this may, along with other undocumented immigrants, threaten our culture. Of course, the question is, what is our culture? And that's really up to debate. What I can say, though, is that we have heard that such and such group, particularly the Chinese, and particularly Catholics, when they started coming in larger numbers, not only from Ireland with the famine, even a little earlier than that, not as big an influx, but a considerable influx in the early years of this country because of political upheavals in Ireland and the revolution, actually, in France. And there were influx of Catholics then, too, that this threatened our culture. There are many, many statements like that, in addition to which they would often be said, as is implied and probably said if one looked hard enough for the quotes today, that these people will not assimilate. They are unassimilable, if that's
mm-hmm.
a word.
Mm-hmm.
Chinese.
And the Chinese ended up living in Chinatowns. They ended up living in enclaves.
They did.
And they spoke their own language because they couldn't assimilate. They weren't allowed to.
And it was a totally...
That's a sort of a conflicting message there, that they won't assimilate, but actually we don't want them to because we're gonna repress them and keep them in their enclaves.
We certainly tried.
Right.
And their language certainly was completely different than anything we were familiar with. And yet, today... Well, and behold, Chinese Americans have assimilated.
Yeah, they certainly have.
You know, as has every other group that's been here.
But if you go back to that 19th century of the mm-hmm. Chinese coming here to work, many of them as indentured servants mm-hmm. originally, the panic actually rose to violence, which you describe in your book. I think our listeners ought to know about that.
Oh, there was particularly in California, where most of the Chinese first came, there were tremendous amounts of violence against them, murderous violence oftentimes. And there was a law in California that prohibited Asians, Chinese, also prohibited Native Americans and blacks from giving testimony in court, that it was not believed that the... They could be trusted.
They could be credible.
Yeah, to take an oath. So on any number of occasions, Chinese immigrants were shot down in public, right in front of their other Chinese people. But those Chinese people could not testify. And often, even if law enforcement wanted to bring a case, and there were many instances where they
couldn't because the witnesses couldn't testify.
Witnesses couldn't testify.
You also point out in 1870 in your book, Mark, you write that a politician named Thomas Mooney ran for governor of California on a platform that one newspaper described as a plan, quote, to exterminate the Mongolian race.
Yes, yes.
There were lynchings in Los Angeles. Buildings were burned. At one point, a mob of 500 whites invaded the Chinatown in L.A., and lynched 19 men. There were also incidents in, Antioch, California, San Francisco.
Yeah.
Places like that.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So, you know, this fear that people won't assimilate is something we've seen through history. One other thing I'd like to say about it is that, it's in the book, too. I think what it represents is a lack of faith in our culture. You fear it's endangered, but you must not have much faith in that culture because
that it's so fragile
that it can be that it would not stand up to challenge of other cultures. When in fact, for as many years as this country has existed as a free nation, people have come here because of that culture and have assimilated in terms of that culture. They may retain their ethnicity. But they, as compared to a culture of monarchy or tyranny, our culture has prevailed. And to want to pass laws to keep them out kind of says, I really don't have much faith in our culture.
Mark Stein is our guest. We're going to take a break here. We'll come back and take some calls. You can join our conversation at 410-662-8780. Mark Stein, who's written plays, he's been a screenwriter. He's a second book of popular history here, this one entitled American Panic, A History of Who Scares Us and Why. A short break. We'll be right back. Whether the underpinnings of a political panic have to do with power, wealth, culture, or religion, all involve the fear of a loss of autonomy. I'm quoting here from Mark Stein's book. Autonomy is not the control of others, it is control of oneself. The fears that form political panic regard the possibility that others will take or reduce our ability to control our own lives or our nation. To some extent, others do limit what we can do as individual, just as other nations limit what the United States can do. It is the boundary of that extent that can generate conflict, and it is those conflicts that occasionally give rise to political panic. A quote from the book American Panic, A History of Who Scares Us and Why, by our guest in this hour of midday, Mark Stein. Let's take a couple of calls, Mark, before we go on. This is an interesting history. I'm actually going to take you back to the granddaddy of all, or grandmother of all panics, the Salem witch trials. Just talk a little bit about that and then sort of march through history with you. But right now, I wanted to take a call from Lorenzo in Joppatown on this subject of immigration. Yeah, hi, Lorenzo. What did you want to add to us?
Well, first of all, great show. But I'm always surprised at how ironic it is that the folks who espouse these views and these fears are the same folks who had those, you know, views and fears and leveled against them when they were immigrants. Say, for instance, I'm African American. It's amazing when I talk to my friends and family, the things they say about, you know, undocumented workers, about, you know, other people, nationalities. It's amazing the feelings they have, and also, you know, and the discriminatory things they say, and I always remind them, are you kidding me? I mean, the things we went through, and you actually think that it's okay to say that and feel that and treat other people that way? Well, it's not the same. It's not, and it's not just African Americans. To me, it's almost any person who espouses those views, and a lot of people do. They just don't say them. But if you put that back into their, you know, face that, hey, you know what, the same people. You know, the folks that said that against the Irish or the Chinese or the Italians years ago, and it wasn't good then. I mean, how do you square the fact that you feel that way? Well, my uncle came here illegally, or my people came. It's always some excuse that, you know, that it wasn't the same in the past. So it just surprises me, and I didn't really have a question, just had a comment.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Lorenzo. Thank you. And I wanted to add something here, and then hear from Mark on this. Because this is complicated. And when you talk to people about what the immigration problem is or what their problem with, first of all, undocumented immigrants, you hear people say, well, they're in the country illegally. They ought to all be deported. You say, well, an estimated 12 million people are going to deport them? Really? How do we do that? What part of illegal don't you understand? So people stand on that, and they say that's where that their objection is. This is against the rule of law to allow people to come across our borders and then give them amnesty, right? That's one. And the other one is the economic concern. There won't be enough jobs. I had a guy call me once and say his job as a sheetrock installer disappeared because of, he said, illegal immigrants. I don't know if they were illegal or not. Okay, so you hear that. So how do you know that there's actually prejudice behind it? Because those seem like sometimes they seem like reasonable and rational arguments to people, to a lot of people. How do you know that there's prejudice behind it? And that leads me to this question for you, Mark. How do you know that this is panic and it isn't just good old-fashioned prejudice or stereotyping or just general contrarianism?
Well, often it is prejudice, and I'm going to write that word down because I want to speak to that in a minute. But I want to also address what Lorenzo mentioned here in a little bit different context first. Because Lorenzo, I think it's fascinating observation you're making, and I know just of what you speak. I'm Jewish, someone who I'm very close to, who's Jewish, made a remark to me a couple of years ago. I don't know if this person would have said it if it wasn't just the two of us in the room, wishing that all Arabs were dead. And I was just, I was just knocked out of my seat. I mean, in the shadow of the Holocaust, how can that thought even get past, even enter the brain? But it did. It did.
Did you respond to it?
Oh, I did. Yeah. I mean, usually not wanting to cause mayhem in the family.
Yeah.
You know, I just don't. But that I did, and she backed off. But you know, the thought was there.
Right.
The other one, to some extent, Lorenzo, you know, I'm as agog as you. I will say this though, particularly in the case of African Americans and the experiences you referenced, you know, there was such resistance, such belief that African Americans could never assimilate into a white society. And curiously enough, the silver lining in what you're saying is that I forget if you mentioned it for his family members or people you know who make these kind of remarks, they've so assimilated that they now make these kind of remarks. So, there's sort of a good side to that in a way, that they're now so totally American, although I don't agree with them either.
Right.
They're
sort of mainstream.
Yeah, in some
ways. If you go by the poll I mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you about this.
If panic is as American as apple pie, you know, there they are.
Well, how do we know that people aren't just being, you said prejudice is a part of it. Stereotyping
right.
is a part of it. And actual fear based on reasonable concerns. In the case of Native Americans, for instance, Indians, some settlers were attacked, right?
Right.
So there was some basis for fear of them.
Right.
We
right.
just got so carried away with it. And
right.
there was a general panic. So do you want to talk a little bit about that
sure.
piece of history?
Yeah, one of the chapters in the book is about Native Americans. And I say at the outset that what's special in this chapter is that it gives us an opportunity to really try to sort out what is the difference between an act of war and an act of panic, whether you support the war of conquest against the Native Americans or not. There were actions that were wars, and then sometimes those wars turned into massacres, and it's where that crosses that line of the military objective, and becoming everyone in this group should die.
Extermination.
Extermination.
And
yes.
then for those who may survive, banish them to a part of the country where it'd be very difficult to live, right? Which is what we did.
Yeah, we did that. We did that
right.
too. And I do write about that, particularly the Trail of Tears
right.
with the Cherokee.
Done with the blessings of the political establishment of the country.
Oh,
right?
and
so that's,
and,
that is real panic. So that's
yes.
that's where fear and panic animated politics.
Right.
Informed politics.
Right. Here's the thing about prejudice and why it's so central to this question of panic. A lot of times, this really began in the 19th century as science became more of an influence on our lives. You would start seeing, and mostly in the realm of African Americans, sometimes in the realm of women, studies that would correlate crime, disease, life expectancy, this, that, and the other with race or with gender. But for now, let's just talk about race. And lo and behold, African Americans came out, looking like they're more inclined to crime, they're more inclined to this and that and the other. As recently as the 60s, a study by Arthur Jensen at Berkeley with IQ tests said, well, you know, blacks tend to have lower IQs. First of all, you could talk about the science and all that, whether the IQ test really measures what it claims to measure and all that, but the just to cut to the chase on that, what is the can be the fallacy of that kind of statistic is correlation, which is what these are. Correlation does not imply causation.
Causation.
Right.
Yeah.
I'll give an example that probably they give in every intro to statistics course, but it's a really valid correlation. Over 99%. Of all murderers, this is astonishing, over 99% of all murderers drank milk as children, but milk did not cause them to be murderers.
Right.
Here's the piece where it connects the panic and to what we call prejudice. Correlation does not imply causation, but it does cause assumption. So that if in our experiences, if in what we've personally experienced, if what people tell us again and again correlates this with that, we will make that assumption. And assumption is absolutely essential to human behavior. Really, to probably all animals.
It's the basis of prejudice, isn't it?
Well, it's the basis of walking down the street.
Yeah,
if we
is.
Didn't make assumptions,
is,
we would
right.
walk down the sidewalk
right.
the same way you cross a creek on
right.
wet rocks. It is such a fundamental
right.
part of behavior and needs to be that it's so easy then to slip into assumptions at this higher level, more abstract level, that might be very faulty.
And from there, you go to things like absolutes, too, right?
Absolutely.
That everybody in the, absolutely, right? Everybody in this group is like that.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Or also unverified claims and gossip.
Yes.
Also feed all of this.
All of this feeds us. And what all of this feeds and is a need for certitude. I believe... It's one of the things I talk about in the book that we all have what I would call a certitude quotient. How much certitude do we need? What I mean by that, I'll give an example outside the realm of politics, is take jealousy. Some people are more jealous than others. They need more certitude in a relationship than others. Why? You'd have to get inside each person's head to understand why. In the same way, some people need more certitude about certain political issues than other people do. I think that's why we see in any of these situations, some people panic when others don't.
Look at the instant crisis in front of us, the immigrant crisis at the border involving lots of children from Central America, three countries in particular.
Yeah.
Some people look at that and see it as a humanitarian crisis.
Yes.
We're a rich, generous nation. We need to do something. Others see it as a complete threat. A violation of law, we must restore order, and we must send them all back.
Yes.
So help me on that.
Yeah, so people who are very upset that we're not doing more to stop this, to the extent that they're upset, to that extent, I would say they need certitude either about law enforcement or about quote-unquote American culture. They need to know... They need to be certain that it will be whatever they...
Safe. Law and order. That we'll have law and order.
And that we'll have the culture we know we have today. Other people, so if we have a few more tacos on our menu or whatever, not so bad.
Not too worried about it.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. By the way, on the flip side, there could be those, and I think there may be, who are pounding their fist about the need to do more humanitarian things. And to that extent, maybe they need certitude about humanitarian issues.
Mark Stein is our guest. His book is American Panic, A History of Who Scares Us and Why. Mark, let's take some more calls while we can. Patrick in Baltimore, we'll go to you. Thanks for joining the conversation.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for letting me join you.
Sure.
Just had one quick comment. Thinking about the word that is part of the title in this book, the first thing that I begin to do is to kind of parse it and move backwards a little bit. I think a lot of times we're really panicked because we have been paranoid. Or we are paranoid. And I think one of the reasons in this country why we are paranoid is a lot of times in examining your conscience, to use a Catholic frame of reference, we find that we have not been treating people well. And so we are paranoid, and then we tend to, as the next element of consideration, become very much caught in this paranoia. What's the word in the title? I'm sorry.
Panic. American panic. But I want to ask you something though. When you talk about paranoia based on what the damage we've done to other countries, other peoples around the world, that would definitely be a concern post World War II. It wouldn't explain earlier panics. I can understand we're concerned about grudges people have, some enemies that we've created along the way, I guess in the last 60 or 70 years. But yeah, is that what you're talking about?
I'm really talking about panic that comes from paranoia on a long-term basis, not just from any one given point. I think Americans too often are tied up in themselves so much that they become paranoid because they have not treated people well externally.
Okay, that's what I was getting at. So you understand my point, Mark, to what he's saying.
Yeah.
I mean, we saved the world in World War II, right? That, at mm-hmm. least that's what mm-hmm. you tell us. But we have created enemies here and there. And our concern after 9/11, for instance, was what did we do to the Muslim world? All these people hate us. And now we have to be, just following Patrick's argument,
Yeah.
Now we got to be paranoid, right?
Yeah.
Now we got to actually panic a little bit about what's happened here.
Yeah. Right? So if I'm understanding this correctly, and I'm not sure I am, but if I'm understanding it correctly, Patrick seems to be, I think, talking about the paranoia, as he put it, the panic, as I put it, as a defense mechanism to the block out that guilt as to things we've done.
I think he's trying to, if Patrick's still there, I think he's trying to explain why we panic because mm-hmm. we're paranoid, and we're paranoid because of this guilt we have because of the way we've treated other nations, other peoples. Patrick's not listening on the radio, but I was wondering if, I hope we got it right, because I think that's, I thought that's what he was getting at. Patrick, are you there?
Patrick's not listening on the radio.
Okay.
I never thought about it from that perspective. I think, Dan, you're right. If that would be a post-World War II perspective.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't explain the Red Scare of the 1920s, for instance, which was panic over invasion from the outsiders, from immigrants, right, that we thought were communists.
Absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. Nevertheless, even you know, if we just kind of take it from World War II, it's an interesting idea. I just never delved into that to that level of it.
Let's take another call. This is Karen in Baltimore joining us on Midday. Hi, Karen.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Good. So I'm going to speak mostly about the situation with our south of the border friends who have come up here and drove for the last 30 or 40 years. I'm in my upper 50s. I'm fairly liberal. I was born in California, worked and trained as a nurse there. Now work in Maryland. And I think the thing that irks so many people, myself included, especially as a former Californian, is that my Norwegian grandparents and my son's Polish and Russian Jewish grandparents didn't come here and expect us to speak Norwegian and speak Russian or speak Yiddish or speak whatever. They came, they maintained whatever cultural ties they wanted to the old country, but didn't expect society to adapt to their linguistic needs. Like I said, I worked in California in the 70s and the early 80s before I moved to Maryland. And even then, we were giving people all sorts of medical care, whether they were legal, whether they were not legal. This continues to this day. And I think that there's a set of, maybe not a panic, but at least for me, there's a fatalism that we can't change it at this point. Yeah, we do have 12 to 15 million people here. So, you can be very non-racist, but just feel like, you know, a lot of California, a lot of
New
Mexico.
So, Karen, I want to get to the bottom line. You resent immigrants because the new breed
of
immigrants?
No, I don't resent
the new
immigrants.
Generation of immigrants because they don't want to speak
because
English?
They're illegal.
Oh, okay. You made it sound like because they don't want to speak English.
That is part of it. A lot of them do want to speak English. But I don't know why in America we have to go to Bank of America and use the ATM or call some helpline. Press 1 for English, press 2.
That's a big skin off your nose, Karen. Yeah, I've heard. I'm sorry. No, stay on the line. Let us stay on the line.
Actually,
please,
don't.
That's not right.
It's not right that you
push
1 for English, push 2 for Spanish?
Yes. Damn, where have you been? That's where it is for most businesses.
Yeah, I know, but I don't resent
it. Say it in English.
It's no skin off my nose. It's no big deal.
My friend, maybe it's no skin off of your nose, but for a lot of us, it just doesn't seem right.
All right.
And I'm sorry, that's the way most people, I take care of everybody who comes before me as a patient or as a human being as an equal. But you come to America, you're welcome to come here legally.
Do all your patients speak English?
You're welcome to come here and learn the English. Yes.
All your patients speak English? You require
them? No, but I still, no, I don't. And I take loving and beautiful care of them. But generally speaking, if you come to our country, come legally and don't expect us to change our society around to for Spanish, French, Norwegian, Swahili. It doesn't matter that it's Spanish.
Okay.
Just, that's the way many Americans feel, myself included.
All right. The English as a second language classes are all full, as far as I know, around Baltimore anyway. That's what people tell me. But go ahead.
I think the only thing I would add, Karen, is something I talk about in the book is in the Midwest in particular, I know in Wisconsin, I believe it was Nebraska, and probably some of the other states there, in the years between the 1840s and the First World War, schools in some of the communities, elementary schools, had classes in, that were taught in German because there were so many German immigrants that they actually taught, it wasn't even bilingual. They taught in German, and then they made efforts. I was reading a book by a wonderful book by a man named Tom August about Milwaukee in particular, how they also offered, of course, language teaching them English, so that this population of children wouldn't fall behind academically. The classes were actually conducted in German. I think it was Nebraska.
I don't think you have to go to Nebraska for this example. Baltimore, the largest immigration group in Baltimore in the 19th century into the early 20th century was German.
Yeah, and there may well have been classes here, too.
I'm pretty sure there were.
Yeah. Nebraska, I think it was after World War I. It's in my book, and I'm sorry I don't remember precisely, passed an English-only
law. Karen is expressing resentment, which I understand, but we're talking about panic here. So, I don't know, resentment plays into panic?
No, I don't know Karen well enough, but nothing that if you're still on the line, Karen, I want to make clear, nothing that I heard you say I would call panic.
Right. She was calling to express resentment
call it a concern.
Why Americans feel so strongly about illegal immigrants coming across the border, threatening our traditional U.S. beliefs and customs.
Mm-hmm. I would call it a concern. I didn't hear anything, even though I don't agree with her. Yeah. I didn't hear her advocate anything that did that which it feared. Two other things just historically to point out, and really that's what my book is trying to do, is show that concerns such as yours are not new. In New Mexico, when it became a state, and for many decades afterwards, all laws, all official documents were published bilingual, English and Spanish, because the predominant population when it became part of the United States was Spanish-speaking. There was one other it's slipping my mind now, but
it seems like transitional accommodations that are made.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
And there really is.
Is the fear that we're going to become a Spanish-speaking nation? What the present fear is right now that could lead to panic?
I suppose. And you know, Spanish could enter our language in the way that other foreign languages have entered our language. One last point about the illegals. My wife actually her father came as a child, so it was okay. But her uncle, who my son is named after, came here in 1921 as an illegal immigrant. The United States had closed its doors. He came from what is now Poland to Canada and on some truck crossed the border, probably a bootlegger's truck. There were so many illegal immigrants that did what he did when he did it that when Roosevelt became president, he declared an amnesty for all illegal immigrants, which is when my wife's Uncle Harry could finally, you know, vote and become a citizen.
Mark Stein is our guest in this hour of Midday. American Panic is his book, A History of Who Scares Us and Why. Mark grew up in Maryland, lives in the District of Columbia, and also teaches at Catholic University and AU at American University.
Right? I had.
You had?
Not currently.
Okay.
Not currently,
well, thank you anyway. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back. Please join our conversation, 410-662-8780. Let's just take some more calls here, and then we'll go back for some more of our History of American Panic with Mark Stein. This is Derek in Pasadena. Thank you for calling Midday. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I'm a millennial, so I like to think that I have a slightly different take on this. And I'm a heterosexual Christian male. And I have to hand it to the GLBT community because what they've done is they've said to everybody, all of their detractors, hey, listen, don't talk to me on the basis of your political or your religious rhetoric. Deal with me on the basis of our collective humanity. And I think the reason that the panic has been sustained is because people aren't actually dealing with people directly. We're kind of dealing with people based on what we've been taught either by the government or by whatever kind of organization we ally ourselves to. Briefly, the call of Karen, I did the census in 2010, and there was an old woman who said the exact same thing, and she didn't want to go into any Spanish-speaking communities. And to me, that reflects the fact that Americans are resentful of vocalization, because there's more than just Spanish on that ATM. There's Japanese, Portuguese, German, and all of that. But I think as Americans, we really don't take, like, foreign language studies seriously as a nation. I would posit that is an assumption that I'm making. And so I think when we're reminded that we have to compete globally, you know, it gets under people's skin because we're thinking, well, English should just stand, you know, as the language everybody should learn. But actually, Spanish is one of the most populous, you know, one of the most widest spoken languages in the world, you know, like after Chinese and Hindi. So the reality is English speakers are, to an extent, in a minority in world languages. And the globalization, I think it really caused my fellow Americans, we get resentful about the fact that we have to compete now. American is number one, but it's like a shaky number one. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, thank you, Derek.
Well, you know, Derek, you bring something up that I think is I talk about in the book, and I think is really germane to a lot of the not just panic, but a lot of the intensity of concern that we're hearing today, and that's in fact yesterday on the show, Michael Kimmel, this is something he's spoken about, written about
Yesterday about angry white men.
Yes. Yeah. Let me jump back and say that you know, when you talk about, you haven't talked about, but when one thinks about what conditions might cause widespread panic and economic distress, periods like that might come to mind. One of the things I learned in writing the book is, while that is true, there can also be, and has been probably more the case, that panic can be spawned by economic achievement or success. I won't go through it all now, but the Louisiana Purchase, there are a lot of panics. We feared we might lose this purchase, things like that. Well, so you talked about globally and competing globally. There have been, since World War II, two incredible achievements in this country, like tectonic. I think Michael Kimmel uses the word seismic, very similar word. One is this. At the end of World War II, for the first time in American history, we were the preeminent political power on the globe, because the rest of the globe was destroyed,
on its
knees, and having to come back.
Mm-hmm.
And up until the end of World War II, white people were the preeminent power in this country. Continuing with that piece of it, after World War II, there was a major technological development called television, and it totally changed the civil rights movement, because suddenly it was brought into people's living rooms, and that contributed domestically to changing who runs this country, who are the people in this country, so that never before have we seen such diversity in our leaders, the people who are in the government of this country. Jumping to the other one after World War II, the economic side, in a sense, it's like if you get straight A's, there's no place to go but down, folks. Indeed, we are not the preeminent power we were when everybody else had their economies in tatters. And also victims of our own success in helping those nations, not repeating the mistake after World War I of trying to hold down our former enemies, helping those nations, so that now we find ourselves having to compete. And it is a tougher field. It is our success. There's a great fear of losing our success economically. And for white folks, among many white folks, a great fear of losing our, being a white folk, our preeminent power, which we are on both scores. And to the extent that someone needs certitude that we will be the biggest power on the globe and white people will be the biggest power in the United States, if you need that certitude, you're going to be pretty freaked out because that ain't the way it's going.
Mark Stein's book is American Panic, A History of Who Scares Us and Why. A couple of comments by email. Jim in Fells Point says, I believe one fear many have is mainly the idea of a foreign culture invading our own. Jake in Hagerstown, picking up on caller, what was his name, Ken or Don, I'm sorry, I can't remember, who was talking about paranoia and guilt related to how we treat other countries, how we have treated other countries over the years.
Patrick.
Was it Patrick?
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah.
Jake says, I think what the caller who was talking about paranoia was getting at wasn't so much guilt about what America has done around the world, but guilt about how they treat people on an interpersonal level. If your worldview is all about taking care of yourself or going it alone or picking yourself up by your bootstraps, then you think everyone else is the same way. So everyone else is an adversary. So people who come here are coming here to do us harm if that is your worldview. Sorry, I didn't quite follow that one. Let's take another email. I mean, another call here. This is Mike in Annapolis. Mike, go right ahead, please.
Hi, gentlemen. Thanks for having me on. I was listening to all this stuff, and I can't help but think that a lot of the panic is politically motivated and to try to move people around through whatever communications device of the day it might be, whether it was, you know, the newspapers of the 19th century or the Internet. If you look at a lot of panic, it's tending to drive people to do something. For example, you know, when Ellen Saubray ran for governor, flyers were handed out in Prince George's County that showed Alabama police sicking dogs on civil rights protesters, and it said, if you vote Republican, you'll go back to this. That's a communications device to panic a certain population to get them to the polls. You see this over and over, whether it's the Red Scares of the 1950s or even xenophobic pushes.
Mm-hmm.
Can you address from your research how you see panics driven by political rhetoric?
Yeah, contrived.
And propaganda for a gain?
Yes. I would use the word contrived in there.
Yeah. Mike, it's a great point, and I do talk about it quite a bit in the book. The panics that are driven from the bottom up, if you will, or panics that are driven from
the top down.
Yeah. Which is, I think, what you're talking about, where if it's politicians or newspaper editors or people simply trying to advance their own agenda, whatever it is, will avail themselves of panic or, if possible, even create a panic for their own agenda. There is a great deal of that. I won't go through the whole details of this, but there is a chapter in there on a very little remembered panic about the Freemasons. Those guys.
Well, we didn't get to the Freemasons.
Yeah, the Freemasons with their red fezes and all.
Yeah.
I'll just
and
say this.
Their aprons and their rituals.
Absolutely.
And their temples.
Right.
Yeah.
And just real briefly, this was a panic. It was a major, widespread panic, totally created by newspaper editors and future political power brokers,
really?
Rather from coming from the bottom up. It's a fascinating panic in that respect.
Because they suspected it was a secret society and they were all up to something, right?
Right, and they used that to tap into larger fears that were prevalent, less specific, and boy, they created a political party out of it called the Anti-Masonic Party.
The Anti-Masonic Party.
Yeah.
Hey, we didn't get to the Salem witch trials either, but we'll leave that to our listeners to get your book if they want to read about that. Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you, Dan. Great to be
Mark
here.
Mark Stein, who joined us again today, his earlier book, How the States Got Their Shapes. This one is American Panic, A History of Who Scares Us and Why. Thank you, Mark. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in to our first hour of midday today, another hour of the show coming up after the news at the top of the hour. Right now, we're going to take a break for lunch on Fridays, provided by Joe Squared Pizza. Joe Squared is located at 133 West North Avenue in the Station North neighborhood of Baltimore, and at the Inner Harbor at the Power Plant Live, Joe Squared. You can find them on the web, too, at joesquared.com. Thank you, Joe Squared, for lunch for our guests. Please stay tuned for the news, and then we'll see you for the second hour.